Yeah. So I think I've been doing this. Bitterfield East is about 8 years old, I think, maybe 9 years old this year. And this is actually my first ever talk, I think. So, yeah, here we go. So I may just get a bit overwhelmed with fear and read what I've written. But I may just try and do a little bit of both. So, the great ship, the rainbow ship, will sail on. Okay, so my talk, so I came up with a title for my talk, and it's called May All Your Weeds Be Wild Flowers. So that's the title for the talk. And I was trying to sort of link it to Amrita's talk yesterday on animism. And in a way, I was thinking, well, so there's this idea about being without a good connection or experiencing the universe as alive, there's no possibility for enlightenment. So I was sort of thinking, well, what is it that gets in the way of that? Well, for myself, I could think of many things like being too busy and just not being in very good connection. So I thought I'd like to talk about ways into that connection, sort of practices that we do or we can do as Buddhists that will help bring that connection more fully. And I also like the idea, I'm going to talk a bit about the use of nature in the teachings. Different symbols and metaphors that come about through the Buddha's enlightenment and story. So just a little bit about that. And also I want to talk about building a Buddha field, which seems quite relevant to me. And yeah, I'll go into that in a minute. Or an eastern Buddha field, at least. So firstly, I'd like to talk about so the Buddha's noble quest. So for those that maybe don't know much about, actually, I think most people do, maybe a couple. So the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, there was a man called Siddhartha Gautama who lived a life of luxury, really. He sort of lived in a world where all his needs were met. He had everything he wanted. He lived in a palace. And but at the same time, he sort of had a bit of a spiritual crisis as well. He kind of, it wasn't quite enough. There was an element to his experience that wasn't quite enough. And he was sort of sheltered from anything difficult, so he's sheltered from old age, sickness, death, but then one day he discovered he was sort of faced with those things. He may have seen people around him getting old. There's other stories that he left the palace and discovered these things. So it made him question, sort of relying on external things for his happiness and security. And he kind of had this spiritual crisis and decided that he was going to try and find a way out. So there's a word in Buddhism called dukkha, which really means unsatisfactoriness. So he's sort of taught that there's an element to all of our experience, whether it's all really good and we're having a really great time, the sun's shining, everything's going our way, there's often still an element. Someone in our group yesterday was talking about it's really, really nice here, but they keep thinking about it's going to end. And what if the sun goes in? And that's kind of, in a way, dukkha. So the Buddha... The Buddha wanted to find a way out of this. And so he left his life of luxury and set out on a noble quest. And so he tried lots of different ways of finding freedom, and eventually found a way that was, well, he'd kind of remembered a time in his youth, and this is one story around when nature comes into it. He was sitting under a tree, a rose apple tree, when he was a boy, and there was something about being under that tree in those particular conditions that he that led him to a state of absorption. So I guess we've all had that experience of sitting under a tree, and there's some kind of calming energy that happens. And he entered a state of absorption. And it was out of this that he then remembered that that would possibly be a way, by just getting into a calm state of mind, he could then maybe go a bit deeper into his experience and understand his experience a bit more. And it's that that led him to understanding the nature of reality. So within this, so within the Buddha's experience of entering a meditative state, so the Buddha was in this palace, and he decided that he wanted to sort of leave, go forth, and discover the meaning of it all. And so he kind of he wanted answers. So he became a wanderer, and along the way he tried all different spiritual practices. And some were quite extreme, different practices at the time in India, where you'd kind of starve yourself to try and find freedom and liberation. And he discovered that this nearly led to death, so that wasn't the way. That wasn't the way. And then he remembered this meditative state as a child under the rose apple tree. So he realised that that could be a way, if he worked directly on his mind, that that could be a way forward for him. So eventually he found a tree. So another tree in the story of the Buddha. He found a tree, which was known as the Bodhi tree that Amrita mentioned yesterday. And he decided to sit down and meditate until he became free. And there's a lovely quote, I can't really remember it, but he kind of, it's like this commitment that happened at that point, that he was determined and committed that that's what he was going to do, and he wasn't going to leave that spot until he'd done that, until he'd reached his goal. Yeah. So he passed through different levels of absorption, plunging deeper and deeper into his mind until eventually he gained insight into the nature of reality. But during this journey, when his resolve was almost complete and things were going really well, he met Mara, and Amrita mentioned Mara yesterday. So he was on the brink of enlightenment, and then Mara came. Yeah. So I find some people don't necessarily relate to Mara quite easily, but I find it quite helpful to sort of personify that sort of energy. And I really like, Padmavajra says, calls Mara, he's like the fascist regime within. He's whatever gets in your way of spiritual growth and obstacles that stop you from transforming. That's Mara. So whether it's the stories you tell yourself, your doubts, your perception of things, whatever gets in your way is Mara. So on the moment of enlightenment, there was Mara saying to him, what are you doing? You can't do this. Who do you think you are? I don't know if anyone else is familiar with that, but I can often have that experience. Mara's often around. And so the Buddha called the Earth Goddess to witness his efforts. And I really love that story. So it's kind of like just getting back in touch with his own experience, his own practice of ethics, his own practice of meditation, his own confidence, his own intentions, and just relying on that rather on Mara and the stories that he may tell you or we may tell ourselves. Yeah. So at that point, Also, I like the idea of there's an image in Lord of the Rings that I thought is a bit like that sometimes. When things are going really, really well, it's a bit like that image when he's at the top of the mountain and the orcs are coming and those armies. It's like Mara's assault. When I think of the story of the Buddha's enlightenment and that moment where, you know, he'd nearly broken free and then Mara came with all his weapons and all those forces to try and stop him. And I think it was a bit like that. I can imagine it being a bit like that. And then the Buddha turned by touching the earth and getting back in touch with his own experiences, his own confidence, he turned all those weapons to flowers. And I think that's a really beautiful image. Yeah. Yeah, so meeting Mara with flowers. Mm. So we have in our community two practices that I think are very helpful to sort of, I guess, to give us the tools to work with situations, experiences, difficulties. So two practices that we're all probably familiar with, mindfulness and metta. I think, you know, the mindfulness practice gives you the opportunity to see the workings of your mind, of Mara, and this space to try and be creative with that. And within the stages of the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, he kind of discovered that whatever mental state appeared, he could just be with that. You don't have to get tied up in it. You don't have to get caught up in it. And that's mindfulness, really. And then he also discovered that he could create other positive mental states and experiences that led to more expansive states, that led to better connection. And I guess that's the metta bhavana practice. And I really like the idea, well, in a way, metta will help us to be in better connection with ourselves and with others and with nature. And I sometimes think of metta as it's a bit like gardening for the heart. So you're doing your weeding, or meditation practice, Buddhist practice is a bit like gardening for the heart. You're kind of, you know, discovering the weeds that are getting in the way of the flowers growing, and by cultivating metta, you know, you're planting new seeds of kindness, of love, of friendliness. And metta also will lead to empathy and compassion, which is, I guess, so important to be in better connection with people. Yeah. So the title of this talk was May All Your Weeds Be Wildflowers. And that came out of a conversation I had with Kshanti Vajra a couple of weeks ago. So personally, at the moment, I haven't been having an easy time. There have been difficult things happening. And, you know, it's just such a reminder of, how I choose to sort of be with that is, you know, samsara, or it's awakening, really. It's growing. So Kshanti Vajra was talking about looking out at his garden, and that he's... So they're in the middle of selling their house as well. And so he was saying that his lawnmower is in for a service, so they can't mow the lawn. And all these flowers are coming out, these daisies. And you could look at that lawn and think, oh my God, the garden really needs cutting. Or you could look at it and see the wild flowers. So that's where the, as a sort of metaphor for being creative with our experience. So may all your weeds be wildflowers. So it's choosing to see beauty as well. And I think that's what else the metta practice can do. So it's not necessarily about liking everyone and being really good friends. There's something about just trying to remain open to someone else's humanity and being concerned for their welfare, I guess. And I guess there's also something about not relating to people on a utilitarian level and what you can get from them. And that's the same with nature. And I think metta practice helps with that as well. I had when I first arrived and I was involved with trying to get the shrine offerings for the ritual, I just went up to a tree and just snapped these two branches off of a tree, but Stuart was nearby and he just shouted out, "Vandal!" And I was just like, oh. And I, you know, I was a bit too caught up in the utilitarian needs of the retreat and the camp and task orientated to even stop and take into account that this tree was living, you know, which is bizarre, considering this is the theme of the retreat. So I then said thank you to the tree, and I've been really appreciating its gifts to us. Yeah. Yeah, so metta and mindfulness. And just finally, just like to say a little bit about creating a Buddha field. So a Buddha field is a Mahayana mythic dimension. So it's a realm that's created by the Buddha's skillful action. You could also look at it as it's a place of where they're the perfect conditions for spiritual growth. In the sutras, it's, you know, they're really beautiful places. They're full of jeweled trees, and your every wish is granted. And you know, the birds are constantly singing. It's just a very positive place to be. And it's a situation that offers us the best context for practicing. So that would be practicing, you know, meditation, ethics, getting closer to how things are, developing wisdom. And I think that's what's always inspired me. There's something about being outdoors for me that's inspired me to want to do this, to do Buddhafield East. And I don't know if it's something about that there isn't a ceiling, or there is in here, but I can still see the sky and I can still feel the air. And there's no walls in a way. So I feel, when I'm out in these conditions, I feel that I can, that I'm more myself or something. Just being in connection with nature brings out more of myself. And I guess nature has its own effect like that. It's part of the conditions that are very positive to being. Less restricting. But I also like to look at, in a way, all of us here, we're creating our own little Buddha fields. I'm creating my own little Buddha field, dependent on how I am in this retreat, how I am in my practice. It has an effect. It's, I guess it links to my name as well, and that's my teachings, to remember to practice as well as I can, so that I can, you know, that I'm aware of the effects that I might have. And to be completely honest, I don't think I've ever found doing this easy. And it is so often a bit of a struggle. These conditions are not the easy option. And but there's a part of me that really, really loves that as well. And part of me that likes to have that sort of challenge and that edge. There's this idea of... a Buddha field is also like a Vajrasana. So the Vajrasana is the Buddha's diamond seat of enlightenment. So that's where he got enlightened. Under the Bodhi tree is the Vajrasana. It's actually where we keep this tent in Suffolk as well, Vajrasana. So there's a nice little link. But you could also look at the Vajrasana as being the conditions that are best for your own enlightenment. So I think for me there's a really good combination. So it's inspiring enough, it's beautiful enough, I feel able to be myself enough in these conditions, but then I'm constantly met with dukkha as well. So an example of that was putting up this rainbow tent for those that were here. That's a perfect example of dukkha. I did hear one someone else saying they'd found a really flat space to put up their tent on. And then they got in it and there was a molehill where they were. And I think when you're camping, it's a real opportunity to sort of meet dukkha a bit more fully. Not that you really need it in the world, because there's often enough of it anyway, but it's so there. There's also something for me about being closer to the Buddha in these conditions. You know, I'm kind of aware that the Buddha lived his life out in nature. You know, he walked barefoot on the grass and he meditated under trees. He was in the elements. And I really like that idea as well. So a Buddha field is a place where the conditions are supportive and perfect even for our own spiritual growth. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the conditions are always comfortable. But then I guess if everything was always comfortable, would we really make much effort to transform and grow? So if you find yourself on a Buddha Field East event and wonder why on earth you're here, at points that you wonder why you're here, rather than being warm and dry and tucked up in bed near a kettle. And if you come up against something in yourself that isn't that comfortable, try and stay with it. So the mindfulness practice, try and stay with it, know it, name it, and try and meet it with metta. Try and meet it with metta, and try and meet others with metta. And so I've been trying to imagine that I've got a handful of flowers at times this week, and just trying to imagine throwing that handful of flowers at Mara when he's there, when I feel a bit up against it. So, and also it's an opportunity to see our experience as wildflowers rather than weeds. So I think that's probably it. There was just one practice I thought I'd like to leave you with. So it's around the Earth Goddess practice. I thought it would be really nice at some point to so just touching the Earth. So imagine if we're in meditation, just touching the Earth. And just trying to get into contact with our own efforts and valuing them, and as much as we can, you know. It can be so easy to get caught up on in what we don't do, or, you know, the stories that Mara is offering us. So just coming into contact, asking the Earth Goddess to witness our efforts and our efforts towards enlightenment. You know, we're all kind of making them. So there's a practice that we do that's called rejoicing in merits. So just taking ourselves into account a bit more and valuing what we do and our efforts with kindness. Yeah. That's it.
So any questions for Sandrine before we hand to Grace?
Can you say more about the practice of rejoicing in merits? What does that entail?
Yeah. So rejoicing in merits, it's sort of seeing somebody's qualities, seeing people more fully, and seeing ourselves more fully, valuing what we do. You know, every little act of generosity that we may do, every act of kindness, and it's going on all the time. We're all doing it in this retreat to each other. So it's really lovely to see, but it's good to kind of bring that more fully into our awareness. And communicate it to someone else as well. If you see something that somebody's done, just let them know that. Let them know that. It's really good to sort of experience people with that sort of appreciative awareness. Hopefully from that we can appreciate nature a bit more as well. I mean, it can be a formal practice as well in our groups. You know, we could... or at the end of the week, you could just rejoice in each other's each other's merits. But I do think there's something, just rejoicing in your own merits is often the most difficult practice. Just rejoicing in your own merits, getting in touch with that yourself as well. Good thing to do. Think of anything? Can you think of anything else around rejoicing in merits?
If you have a positive thought towards someone, or act on it, rather than thinking, oh, we'll do that later on. And I think of that as a practice of rejoicing in merits. It's acting on positive intentions early, for instance, if you see someone doing something and you really like what they're doing, you think, oh, I'd like to give them something, or is it a sign of just enjoying what they're doing, and, you know, picking it, asking a flower if it doesn't mind being picked, and giving that to them, or something they like, or just telling them, just saying how you enjoyed how they did that job, or the way they spoke, or it's a practice to say something positively to another person, and it engenders friendship.
Generous.
I'd like to ask, I see you as a very brave person, and I'd like to ask, what that moment felt like? Was it an experience of being in Butterfield West and suddenly saying, yeah, I'm going to do this in the East? And how did you get brave enough to start it?
It wasn't me on my own for a start.
Yeah.
So that's Dagmar was one of the original people as well. So I think there were a few of us that went to the Butterfield Festival.
Yeah.
I think I'd been coming along to the Colchester Buddhist Centre for a few months, and then I went to the Butterfield Festival, and it was just like there was something about the Buddhist Centre for me at the time. It's not like that now, but for me at the time, I felt like I had to be a certain way to be there. And then I got to the Butterfield Festival, which felt much more my language, my experience. But what's been really great, and what is really great about our movement, is that, you know, I can actually do that in a Buddhist centre as well. I can still, you know, so I've helped to create Butterfield East, but at the same time I've been involved with the Buddhist centre as well. And I think for me there was a point of realising that I didn't have to chop bits off of myself to be a Buddhist. I could just be more and more myself, and that's all right as well. But this context definitely, I do find, meets my needs a bit more fully, or speaks to me a bit more fully. And maybe it's just about being in nature. Yeah, I don't know. No, I'm sure it's not just about being in nature. I just think people become more and more themselves in this environment. That's not to say, of course, that they don't in a Buddhist centre. But I guess we spend larger amounts of time together here, and we see each other a bit more fully as well.
I think I'd like to the practice of asking the Earth Goddess to witness our efforts, and just, you know, holding the Earth, being in touch with the Earth. I love that physical idea of possibility, and I think I'd like to incorporate that more. It's much more kinesthetic and a connection as well. That's really good.
I discovered it yesterday. It's quite useful.
Say how?
It was all around this talk, actually, kind of Mara. Mara coming, and then just I had this moment of just driving. So I'm camped under the oak tree, and I just walked up to the oak tree and just felt the oak tree, and something about that connected me with the Earth Goddess somehow. And I remembered, just kind of, it just clicked. I just thought, hang on a minute, what are you doing? All this doubt and stories I may tell myself. And then I just thought, look, you know, I've got my experience. I've been practicing for 11, 12 years. I've put in a lot of effort and I can rely on that, you know. So that kind of undermined Mara, the great underminer.
So I think I'd just like to rejoice in your merit, actually. To rejoice in your merit of looking at that so fully and overcoming whatever was coming your way and actually delivering a really good talk.
Thank you, Maggie.
And I rejoice in your honesty. You've really examined yourself thoroughly. You've even laid yourself open by explaining your fears and doubts and nervousness about the talk. And so.
I think this context as well has been such a, you know, because I've had to really learn how to be, and I still am learning how to be. You know, with the sort of, there is a utilitarian need when you're trying to organise an event, and it is really a fine line between seeing people as use and also, you know, just appreciating people. There's this great teaching that our teacher, Sangharajita, sort of talks about, the greater mandala of uselessness. And it's such a lovely teaching that I personally want to practice more and more, so that's not relating to things on a utilitarian level. Yeah, but there is an element needed to do this as well, so it's kind of just trying to be aware of the line. Yeah. Can I just say, I'd like to rejoice in somebody. I've put him on the shrine. Well, there's Sangharajita there, but behind that there's John, or Jonathan, who has been also quite a big part of creating Butterfield East. And he's actually in the middle of being ordained. And I had a feeling that it's got something to do with today. So I just wanted to rejoice in he who was John, or Jonathan. And, yeah, he's been a big part of Butterfield East as well. So that's why he's on the shrine, if anyone wondered. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's not what he's wearing now. That was a fancy dress party. Oh. So, yeah. Those of you that know him, just try and bear him in mind, because he's in the middle of spiritual rebirth right now, I think. Yeah.
And Ray as well, if you know.
Yeah.
If you know Ray. He's with him.